I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome back to Radio Times. Say the word Amish, and chances are you'll imagine buggies and barn raising, simple handmade clothing, brimmed hats and bonnets, horses plowing fields, and homes without electricity and modern conveniences. While that does describe some of the Amish culture, our guest Donald Craybill says it doesn't begin to describe the diversity of the Amish way of life. He's an authority on this religious group and the co-author of a new book called The Amish, a companion to the PBS documentary that first aired last year. It's part history and part exploration of how the Amish are living and dealing with an encroaching modernity. Donald Craybill is a senior fellow at the Young Center for Anabaptist and Pietist Studies at Elizabethtown College, where he's a distinguished professor. The center recently hosted a conference titled Amish America, Plain Technology in a Cyber World. Donald Craybill hopped on a train and joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's my delight to be with you.
What is the most prevalent misconception you think about the Amish?
I think the most prevalent misconception is they don't use any technology. They are Luddites that reject all modern technology. The fact of the matter is many of them do use a variety of technologies. They selectively make decisions about what they reject, what they accept, and what they adapt. And one of the foci of our conferences last week was to look at how they adapt and change and modify technology so that it fits within their moral order. So they do use a lot of technology, yeah. But they're very thoughtful about what they accept, what they reject, and how they change it.
And is it possible to understand the thinking that goes behind, yes, maybe I will use, what, a cell phone?
Right.
Help us understand
well,
that.
Well, the key decision, the key perspective underlying their decisions are how will this change our community? For example, let's take the car.
Right.
The concern there is if we have cars, that will fragment our community. People will leave the community. They'll drive away to work. Families will be pulled apart. And so by rejecting the car and keeping the horse, it keeps the community together. And they don't make moral judgments such as those that, you know, a car is sinful or wrong or the people that drive cars are going to hell. But as one bishop said to me, it's a question about the next generation.
Hmm.
Where will this take the church? What will happen to our young people if we accept a car? And so the horse, in a sense, holds the community together by having local travel. It's what I like to call the social work of horses to sort of keep the community together.
But what's interesting is, and I'm sort of stuck on cell phones here, I guess, because I know some Amish do use cell phones. I mean, I guess it does keep you in the community, but it does connect you to this much wider world.
It does. And that really brings up the key point in our book, and that is the enormous diversity in North America. Some groups completely reject the cell phone. In fact, the most conservative groups won't even touch a regular landline phone. If they need to make a call, they will go to an English meaning outside person, to a local English neighbor and actually have the neighbor place the call. They will speak to the neighbor and explain what they want. Whereas in more progressive groups, such as in the Lancaster area, in some of the congregations, cell phones are acceptable. There are young people that have smartphones. And that's a controversy and mm-hmm. an issue for considerable discussion now because, again, the issue is where is this going to take us? Is it going to connect us to the outside world in ways that we don't want? But on the other hand, it supports our community. We can talk together and communicate in ways that we weren't able to in the past. But on the other hand, young teenagers can have a smartphone out in a cornfield
mm-hmm.
and have the entire world in their pocket. And one of the arguments we make in the book is that in the 20th century, you could see a car, you could see a tractor, you could see a telephone line coming into the house. But postmodern technology, cyber technology, much of it's invisible. And you can stick this gadget in your pocket and have everything from the world literally in your pocket. You don't have to go to New York City or Chicago or go to a theater or go to a movie in town. So
right
it's
there.
A completely different threat to Amish identity and a completely different challenge to Amish identity than it was in the 20th century.
But should we be surprised that there is this diversity? And I guess like all religions, there are people that are very traditional. There are people that are very progressive, that there is this diversity of philosophy, of way of life, of thinking about the world.
Well, you asked, Marty, about what's the greatest misconception when we started. I think a second major misconception is if you've seen one Amish person, you've seen them all, that they're somehow all cut from the same cultural cookie cutter, and they're all identical. They're homogeneous. The fact of the matter is there's an enormous diversity. One of the major contributions of the book is we identified 40 different Amish tribes, 40 different subgroups, so to speak, and they all have their own regulations, different patterns of dress, different ways of interacting with the outside world. For example, in Lancaster County, many Amish people in the rural areas are members of local fire companies. They fight the fires. They're active in local civic things. If you go to Missouri, go to New York State, go to Michigan, and some of the more traditional areas, Amish people aren't involved in any of those things. Some of them in the traditional groups only have outdoor privies. They don't have water under pressure. They're not taking a bath in a shower or a bathtub, but they're taking bath in a big copper tub like our great-grandparents may have in late 19th century. Come to Holmes County, the Cleveland area of Ohio, northern Indiana, or Lancaster County, and they have state-of-the-art bathrooms. They have state-of-the-art cabinetry. They have LED lights on their carriages, whereas the traditional groups will have just a kerosene lantern literally on the carriage. So I could go on and on. There's just like dozens of differences, and that means the Amish world is rather complicated and complex. And what you see in Maryland, St. Mary's County, Maryland, or what you see in Dover, Delaware, is going to be different than what you see in central New York State with these 40 different tribes.
Your book in part tells the history of the Amish and where they came from, including the kind of persecution that they suffered, and this was several centuries ago, and looks like they came to what became the United States of America, looking for religious freedom, like a lot of people.
That's correct. They wanted religious freedom. They had been pushed around. Many of their ancestors were burned at the stake, roasted, if you please, because of their belief in adult baptism and belief in the separation of church and state. Many received a medieval equivalent of the electric chair, namely burning at the stake. And so there is that persecution history, and we suggest in the book that American society has been very good to the Amish. I mean, there's been a remarkable sense of toleration and acceptance here to the credit of our American way of life. One example is Amish children terminate their education at the eighth grade. The U.S. Supreme Court supported that in 1972 in a major decision known as Wisconsin versus Yoder. They are exempted from the Social Security system, which is, again, a very remarkable thing because they want to take care of themselves and feel that they're accountable to help each other physically if there's fire or storm, if there is a problem in a family that the family can't cope, that they don't want to depend on outside government handouts or government support programs. So they came here for religious freedom, and America in many ways has been very good to them.
And is the Bible their sort of central scripture, or are there other scriptures as well?
The central scripture is the New Testament. They're very, I would say, Christocentric. The Sermon on the Mount is what is central to them. They all of the scriptures that are read in their church services throughout the year are from the New Testament, and the over half of those are from the Gospel of Matthew. And so it's a high focus on Jesus' teachings that they do tell stories from the Old Testament. They don't discredit the Old Testament, but they see the Old Testament leading to Jesus. For example, they are conscientious objectors to war. That comes directly from Jesus' teaching to love your enemies and forgive those who persecute you and so on.
But even going back to the persecution, they didn't believe in child baptism, but they believed in adult baptism. The idea that as an adult, what, you could freely choose your religion?
Correct. They believed that you should make a voluntary decision. I mean, they were arguing with the Catholic Church and also with the Protestant Church. They begin in 1525, their ancestors, and that's just about 8 years after the Protestant Reformation. And the Protestant churches were also baptizing infants at that time. So their argument was that, and if you think about it, it's a very modern argument.
It is.
It's ironic.
It is.
I mean, they're saying adults should make adult decisions about whether they want to affiliate with a church or not, and if they want to affirm a particular religious affiliation. The other issue that also was a very modern idea at the very beginning was the separation of church and state, because in medieval Europe, church and state were all in bed together, so to speak. They were married and integrated together. And so these people, the Anabaptists, forerunners of the Amish, were arguing that the church, the state, should not interfere with the church, and if the individuals decide there should be voluntary baptism based on the scripture, then the state should respect that. And that is a very streak of dawn in terms of our modern concept of the separation of church and state. So there, these people who we think are very traditional and dyed in the wool, I mean, their ancestors really on the cutting edge on those two principles.
There are, of course, Amish living all over this country and in many other countries as well, but I think anyone that's been to the Lancaster area at almost at any time, including currently, knows that Pennsylvania was a place where a lot of Amish people settled. What was the draw to this state?
Well, the draw was Philadelphia and William Penn and Penn's Woods, and they settled first, came in through the Germantown area here, and then moved there for good farmland. They were in Berks County first, up in the Reading area, and then moved into Lancaster mm-hmm. County, then moved west into central Pennsylvania, and then eventually west in Ohio. So it was freedom of religion and good land with great limestone soil. And today, Pennsylvania has about 65,000 Amish people out of a national population of 280,000. Pennsylvania and Ohio are sort of neck and neck with about 65,000. Mm-hmm. There are 52 different geographical settlements in Pennsylvania, and about half of those in Pennsylvania live in the Lancaster area. Maryland has three settlements, and Dover, Delaware has a settlement. So there's a few also in the Mid-Atlantic region here, but the primary, the lion's share, so to speak, is in Pennsylvania.
We're just about up on a break here, but you have a photograph that you took in Japan of a,
I did, yes.
Of an Amish
yes.
woman.
No, actually, she's Japanese.
Oh, she's Japanese.
She's Japanese, dressed like an Amish woman.
Let's take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation with Donald Krabill, an expert on the Amish and co-author of a new book called, very simply, The Amish. And we are going to talk much more about the Amish after this very short break. He's a professor at Elizabethtown College, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Visit Annapolis.org supports WHYY. History, fine dining, entertainment, and the Chesapeake Bay are part of what can be discovered in Annapolis throughout the year. A list of this summer's events and activities is available at visitannapolis.org.
In Studio 360, we strive for balance.
We're trying to capture something that's real, but at the same time, we're trying to capture something that can be used to underline certain themes or ideas.
Like filmmaker Errol Morris, we can be a little opinionated. Every week, we bring you outspoken stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and big ideas. Get inside the creative mind.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
There's been a lot in the news lately about the challenge of being a mom, but with Father's Day coming up, we thought it was high time for some pointers on being a modern dad. Our panel fires up the grill and throws on your questions by Twitter and Facebook. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Brick Simple LLC supports WHYY. Serving Fortune 500s to startups, Brick Simple provides technology consulting and app development for the web, iPhone, iPad, Android, and Google Glass. More at BrickSimple.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Donald Krehbiel, distinguished professor at Elizabethtown College, that's in Pennsylvania. He's also the author and the editor of a number of books, including The Riddle of Amish Culture, The Amish Way, Amish Enterprise, Amish Grace, and co-author of a new book called The Amish, and a companion book to the PBS series that ran last year. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. During the break, we both agreed that the best segue from where we were talking about adult baptism is to talk about Rumspringa, which you write about in the book. I think people have probably heard about it, but probably don't understand it. Rumspringa means, quote, running around.
Correct. And basically what it means is that until Amish young people reach the age 16, they are engaged with family activities. Saturday night, weekends, they're with their family. But at the point they turn 16, then they're able to go out on weekends or evenings with their friends and hang out with their friends. And so it means running around. It's a time to look for a marital partner. Many of them get married at a young age, 19 or 20, and so they have 3 or 4 years to be out hanging out with their friends. And at this stage yet, they are not baptized into the church because of the Amish principle of adult voluntary baptism. They'll typically wait till they're 19 or 20 to be baptized into the church. So because of that, they're not under the regulations of the church. This is a very modern idea in some ways that, you know, the Amish parents are not indoctrinating and enforcing or requiring the kids to join the church, but they have this voluntary option. But some of them get engaged in outside worldly activities. One of the myths of Rumspringa is they don't move away from home. Many people think, well, they move off to the city for 3 years and then come back. That's not true. Probably less than half of 1% would do that. Most of them are living at home. Some of the more rambunctious boys will get a car. They may have parties. They hang out and do things that would not be acceptable for church members.
Like drinking,
and so on. But 90% of them eventually will then join the church and become part of the adult life of the church and really conform to its rules and regulations.
Well, quoting from your book, the Rumspringa experience has several layers, psychological, religious, and social. It's a psychological journey and self-understanding, a search for identity that fits within the contours of Amish society. And again, it seems very progressive. I mean, I think there are a lot of parents that think that their 16 and 17-year-old kids, they certainly want to go kind of crazy for a while, and this sort of gives them the opportunity to do that, but within the structure, the loose structure of Amish culture.
That's actually a very important point, because even though they may be experimenting with the outside world, they're doing it in a little mobile Amish society. Their 5 or 6 other friends are all Amish, so the experience is being filtered through Amish lenses, so to speak. And nevertheless, they come back and then really will join the community.
And do most of them come back after,
most of them
after
do.
Having this
in the
Lancaster kind of
area? It could be 90 to 95%. Nationally, it's around 85%. One of the things we found in the book is the plainer the group, the greater the retention. And so that means the more traditional groups are actually growing faster. Number one, because they have bigger families. Number two, because they retain more of their young people.
You write about, problems in families. And I don't think we should be surprised that in Amish families there are occasional, sometimes problems of child abuse and domestic violence. How do Amish deal with that?
Well, these people are people. They're human beings. And all of the issues that we see in other human communities, we see in some form of manifestation in Amish communities. In terms of, let's take domestic violence, if there would be physical abuse. And the best evidence we have is that that's very low. There is some, but it, comparatively, it's very low. the church has its own judicial system, so to speak. And if someone violates that, the regulations, and would be physically abusive, they would be asked to make a confession in front of the church. It's a very humiliating thing. The church is a local congregation of 20 to 40 families. If they refuse to do that, then they would be urged to change their ways. If not, then they would be excommunicated eventually. But typically, they may confess and then straighten their lives out and go on. Where the judicial system breaks down or is less effective is with abusive, addictive things, like if they're a case of alcoholism or a sexual predator that's addictive. You know, they may come back and confess and say they're sorry three or four times, but keep on doing the deviant behavior, which is often the case of an alcoholic. And so at that point, the church may struggle. They're reluctant to go outside, but there may be mandatory reporters, physicians or midwives or neighbors that become aware of this and encourage reporting to the outside authorities.
And getting some kind of treatment
exactly.
for
and
an addiction.
To their benefit, the Amish have set up various mental health centers for various forms of treatment. A major one near Lancaster, Pennsylvania, is on the actually built on the campus of a psychiatric mainstream facility. So there's a whole new willingness to take responsibility to deal with these things. But nevertheless, there are examples of sexual abuse or some physical abuse occasionally.
You mentioned confession. I mean, is this what? Could you call this a shaming?
It's a shaming
kind of ritual.
It's a shaming ritual. Absolutely. Here you are in front of your family, your closest friends, and the church members who you've committed to be part of for the rest of your life, and you are on your knees in front of the congregation. This isn't a private confession to a priest in a private confession booth somewhere. I mean, it's very public. It's very much a shaming ritual, and I would say generally it's very effective.
Because of the community, the power of community, do you think?
This is your only community. I mean, these are the people you love and know and you care about, and you want to be in good standing with them. And so it's a powerful form of social control.
And that's Donald Craybill, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about the Amish, something that he knows quite a bit about, an authority on the Amish, co-author of a new book called, very simply, The Amish. And again, distinguished professor at Elizabethtown College. And we have a bunch of callers that want to join our conversation at 1-888-477-9499. I think the last time we had you on the show was that tragic murder where a man came into an Amish school and gunned down a number of children, turned the gun on himself, and the Amish community did an extraordinary thing, I think, by, you know, our sort of modern worldly standards.
Well, this is in 2006 in Lancaster County. A neighboring man, not Amish, came in and, in execution style, shot 10 Amish girls between the ages of 6 and 14. Five of them died, five survived, and it was a horrific, horrific thing. And within 6 or 7 hours, various members of the Amish community spontaneously went to the gunman's widow, went to the parents of the gunman to express grace, to express forgiveness, and express compassion. They said, we want you to still live in our community. It was kind of a tribal-to-tribal thing because the parents were at hospitals worrying about whether their children were going to survive. And so these were spontaneous expressions from Amish people going to the family of the man that did the shooting, saying, look, somebody from your tribe did something terrible to 10 of our young girls who are innocent, and we just want you to know that we're not going to retaliate.
Well.
And as I talked to one father who lost a daughter, and I said to him, I said, Amos, how would you define forgiveness? He said, you know, it means, for me, it means giving up my right to revenge. That's powerful stuff.
It is.
And it was deep, moving, giving up my right to revenge. I mean, all of us would like to hang on to that right to retaliate when people harm us. So that was a very powerful statement that takes us to the very heart of Amish spirituality and Amish religious experience.
And did that wife of the man who murdered the children, did she stay in that community?
She did. She actually moved. She was remarried sometime later and then moved about 5 miles away. Hmm. But she didn't go far away. And the mother of the man that did the shooting also developed a close relationship with the families and still keeps that relationship. And if you think about it, I actually, in a revised edition of Amish Grace, interview the mother because her question was, can I forgive my son? Mm. I mean, what would it be like to have a mother, to be a mother, to have a son that would do that? I mean, it's really heavy, complicated stuff. And to her credit, she has done a phenomenal job of cultivating very positive relationships mm-hmm. in the Amish community.
Let me ask you about that, what I think we could describe as the dark side. And this is a group in Ohio. They've been convicted of, I guess, a hate crime, of cutting beards
Correct.
Off of other Amish people. It almost sounded like a cult. These were just the news accounts of this group
of
people.
Well, we can talk a couple hours about this,
we could
Marty.
Indeed.
I was actually an expert witness to the counsel, to the prosecutors for 9 months. I was on the witness stand for 5 hours at the trial last September. There were 16 defendants, and they were charged with federal hate crimes. They were charged with 90 different counts, and they were convicted of 87 of those. So the lead person, the bishop, is in prison for 15 years. In my judgment, many of their practices clearly were similar to what we would typically call a cult in terms of abuse of power, enforcing, threatening physical punishment if people wanted to leave, sexual abuse. And in my judgment, these are not Amish. They were former Amish, but they rejected a lot of the basic Amish teachings. I mean, it's unheard of for Amish people to attack others. And so it's a complicated story,
yes.
But in my judgment, a renegade Amish that left the church because they categorically rejected many of the basic teachings of the church. It's a very sad story.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation, including, it looks like, Rose from Haddon Heights. And Rose, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm enjoying the conversation.
Thank
I
you.
Used to deal with the Amish in the 80s. We had an antique shop, and we would buy quilts and furniture. And what we found was that they used a lot of modern things like shiny vinyl floors, and their children had magic markers, and they had vinyl siding. But they weren't necessarily dependent on those things. And the other thing that I wanted to comment about is that I believe that the Amish participated in a landmark study on schizophrenia that showed that schizophrenia was evenly distributed through the population, that it wasn't a result of an industrial society.
Hmm.
And I'll just take my comments off the air. Thank you.
No, you're welcome, Rose. Thanks for the call to Radio Times.
Well, let me just say, in terms of the modern things you were noticing, yes, that's exactly the point I wanted to make at the beginning. They do use some state-of-the-art things, but then other things they reject. And again, their concern about making those decisions and selecting the technology is, will this new gadget or this technology help to build up our community and enhance our community, or will it tear it down and pull it apart? On the medical research, what's fascinating is in the last 10 years, the Amish have been closely involved. I'm speaking now about the Lancaster, southeastern Pennsylvania Amish, in major medical research studies. Some of these are done at the Clinic for Special Children in Strasbourg. Some closer to Lancaster City, there's an Amish research clinic. The physicians in these clinics and researchers have gathered DNA samples on thousands of Amish people in the Lancaster area. And they are making, through the research and through the Amish cooperation, they're making great contributions mm-hmm. to genomic science and learning about human disease that's not only an issue in the Amish community, but is applicable to the broader human community worldwide.
Well, and I would think because we're talking about such a small group of people that there is this issue of intermarriage. I think you call it endogamy.
Well, endogamy is it means you marry within the group. If
right.
Catholics marry Catholics, that's endogamy. So they do require, in other words, a bishop will not marry an Amish girl, an Episcopalian man.
Gotcha.
Okay? So you both need to be a member of the church. Now, you could come out from the outside. You may be born Episcopalian and join the Amish when you're 21, and then you could marry an Amish girl. So, but there are second cousins that sometimes marry or third cousins. There are certain diseases that express themselves more frequently in the Amish community. But those are not necessarily Amish diseases.
Hmm.
They are heritable diseases, but all of us have hereditary diseases. I have heart disease. I have some other things that are hereditary. So it's not that it's necessarily unique or distinctive to the Amish community to have hereditary disease.
Let me get to, it looks like Gene from Cinnaminson to join us on Radio Times. And Gene, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, you may have seen or heard of this supposed reality show Breaking Amish, which essentially shows Amish mobsters. And I was always of the opinion that it's just a Hollywood creation and a real insult to the Amish. Do you know anything about this?
I'm sure. Well, yeah, go ahead.
I think you're referring to Amish Mafia. There's actually two so-called reality shows, Breaking Amish and Amish Mafia. The gangster one is Amish Mafia. It's a reality show that has no reality in it. It's based on imagination and fabrications. And even in the promotion of it, there's a lot of lies because it says these scenes are reenactments, which is not true. There is nothing like an Amish Mafia. And all of this is fabricated, made up by the producers. Now, some of the actors are from the Amish community. These are young people that grew up and then did not join the church and were rebellious. Some of them have dubious criminal records to begin with. And they know and understand Amish practices, so they were able to help create believable kind of scenes. But there is nothing such as an Amish mafia, and it's really an outrage mm-hmm. in the Amish community because Amish people feel like they're being exploited by it and that these are falsehoods that are being spread around the world that really have nothing to do with reality, despite the fact that these are called reality TV shows.
And looking at a list here, National Geographic, Amish Out of Order, UPN's Amish in the City, TLC's Breaking Amish, and Discovery Channel's Amish Mafia.
There's been maybe 10 of these over the last 10 years, and the most recent ones are Breaking Amish and Amish Mafia. Now, Breaking Amish gets a little closer to reality because those are young people who are breaking away, and yet they're not typical Amish people. They're more rebellious. But the next step away from reality is Amish Mafia, where it really it does not represent at all Amish life. And so part of our book is to give the facts and document real Amish life.
And the book is called The Amish. And our guest is Donald Krehbill, distinguished professor at Elizabethtown College and authority on the Amish. And we're taking more calls at 1-888-477-9499. Gene, thanks for the call. Again, 1-888-477-WHYY. We'll be right back.
The rate of new HIV infection in Philadelphia is 5 times the national average. There are more than 30,000 living with the virus in our city, and 1 in 5 don't know it. June is AIDS Education Month, and Philadelphia Fight is holding events throughout June for youth, faith leaders, medical providers, and the greater community, including National HIV Testing Day on June 27th. All events are open to the public. More about AIDS Education Month at fight.org/AEM. Philadelphia Fight supports WHYY.
We got 12 bottles of water, 56 beers, 2 vodkas, 4 whiskey, 6 bottles of wine, tequila, Nutella, cheese, steaks, a Milky Way.
That's Seth Rogen in This Is the End, a parody of End of the World movies. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Rogen and Evan Goldberg, who co-wrote and co-directed the film and co-wrote Superbad. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. How much surveillance are you willing to live with? Also, Caroline Elkins, who was vilified for her claim of abuse of Kenyans by the British decades ago. She won a Pulitzer for her book. Now she can say she helped win reparations. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We are talking about the Amish. The Amish more than barn raisings and horses and buggies and brimmed hats and bonnets and horses plowing fields. Our guest, Donald Craybill, is a distinguished professor at Elizabethtown College, and his book is about the diversity of the Amish culture. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I came across an article a couple of years ago, but it says here, want to find America's most successful entrepreneurs? Skip Silicon Valley and Manhattan. Head to the rural Amish enclaves. Amish businesses have an eye-popping 95% success rate. Should we be surprised by that?
Well, not in the Amish world, but it's striking because in the outside society, the startup rate, the failure is about 60%, 65%. So it's just remarkable how Amish people can start businesses that are very successful. This relates to the fact that today, across North America, on the average, fewer than 50% of Amish households receive their income from farming. One of the stereotypes is that all Amish are farmers, horses in the field, okay? But the fact of the matter is, like in the Lancaster area, only about 30% of the households receive their income from farming. Mm. Since 1980, Amish communities have developed many of their own businesses. And I've done a lot of research with some colleagues on Amish entrepreneurs. And this is really fascinating, Marty, because these entrepreneurs go to a one-room Amish school taught by a teacher who was also educated through the eighth grade, period. There's no technology in these schools, okay? These pupils graduate when they're 14, then they go into apprenticeships, and they're in self-designed, in the community, apprenticeships in manufacturing and woodworking and machine shops and so on. And then eventually they move some of them into ownership. And these businesses are very profitable and very successful. There are 12,000 of these Amish-owned businesses across North America, some 2,000 in Lancaster County. And these entrepreneurs haven't gone to the Wharton School. They don't have an MBA. They have not gone to high school, and all the technology that they use and know is self-taught and self-trained. But they have the advantage of the quote-unquote Amish brand. And although other outside companies would pay millions of dollars to create a brand and protect it, the Amish brand suggests things like strong value, craftsmanship, homespun, high quality, durable. It's a symbol of sort of Americana and traditional American values, and that is a powerful brand that a young entrepreneur will receive without paying for it or developing it. But these are enormously successful businesses.
So we're talking about wealthy Amish people?
We're talking about Amish millionaires, and it's no longer an oxymoron. These businesses are based on hard work. They're based on low overhead. No air conditioners, no red carpets, no executive suites. One of the things that I found when I interview Amish entrepreneurs, they're usually out in the shop working with their employees. They do their books at night. They are small. There are no big ones. The church really frowns on businesses get larger than a dozen or 15 employees because they want them to be more egalitarian. But what that did was spread businesses all across the settlement because you don't have a big Amish factory with 500 workers. Anyway, it's a remarkable success story that emulates a lot of fundamental American values of hard work, productivity, creativity, innovation.
Branding,
exactly.
Let me get some callers back in on the conversation. Looks like we have Bob from Cornwall, Pennsylvania. And Bob, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Do we, Do we have Bob? Nope, we seem to have lost Bob. We will get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. How did you become so interested in the Amish? I'm curious about that.
Well, I grew up in Lancaster County, and believe it or not, I came to Philadelphia for my graduate work at Temple University in the late 60s and studied with John A. Hostetler, who was the leading authority on Amish life in America at that point. And that sort of stimulated my interest. Then when I went back, to Lancaster County, was teaching at Elizabethtown, I became curious more about Amish life. I had grown up in a dairy farm in Lancaster County, and they were nearby, and I became hooked, so to speak, on a question that I deal with in my earlier book, The Riddle of Amish Culture. It's basically this question: how is it possible for a traditional group that rejects high school, rejects automobile ownership, rejects television, rejects the ownership of computers, how is it possible for a group like that not only to survive, but to thrive in American high-tech, hyper-modern society? This community doubles every 20 years. Today, there are twice as many Amish in Lancaster County as there were 20 years ago. How is that possible? I'm a cultural sociologist, and so I'm curious about how do they negotiate with modernity? How do they sort out what they'll accept, what they'll reject, so that they can retain their identity, keep their community solidarity, and yet tap the fruits of modern life? So that intellectual question has sort of driven a lot of my work and still intrigues me today.
Well, I would assume we're talking large families as well.
Well,
which has helped to grow the population.
It depends on the group. In Lancaster County, we're talking 7 children. In some more progressive, in Ohio, 5 children. In the more traditional, we're talking 12 children. So it varies from, but yes, compared to the two-child American family, yes, large families.
Is there, they don't proselytize, though. I mean,
that's correct. They aren't engaged in evangelism or mission work in the way other Protestant or evangelical groups are. They will accept outsiders. There are about 50 adults who have joined the Amish church from the outside and who have stayed. There have been more that have tried to join or have joined and then, when they saw how hard it was to hitch up a horse or learn to speak Pennsylvania Dutch, they left. But they do welcome outsiders, but they aren't aggressively seeking converts.
Let me get some callers back in on the conversation. Looks like we have Matthew from Westchester joining us on Radio Times. Matthew, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I had a question, please, to the author. Is there, say, for example, I used to live in Lancaster City for like the last 5 or 6 years on Lemon Street, across the street from Lancaster County Hospital. I would like to know, say, the similarities and the differences between Amish and the Mennonite, and are some of them related to each other? And I guess that's all I have to ask.
That's okay.
Thank you.
Well, you're welcome, Matthew. The difference between Mennonites
right,
and Amish.
The Amish and the Mennonites have a similar, they have the same religious tradition that starts in 1525 in Germany at the time of the Protestant Reformation in Switzerland and Germany. And then they separate into two distinct groups in 1693. So when they come to the New World, so to speak, they are in separate groups. Today, all of the Amish, by definition, drive horse and buggy for their primary mode of transportation. In the Mennonite world, there's greater diversity than there is in the Amish world. There's only a small percentage of Mennonites that drive horse and buggy. 95% of Mennonites drive cars, and many of them are assimilated into American life in some ways, such as they accept higher education, they may own software companies, some of them teach at leading public universities. So there's enormous diversity. Some of the basic values and beliefs, such as conscientious objection to war, emphasis on service, emphasis on community, emphasis on the simple life, those things are frequently similar between the two groups. But there's, for all practical purposes, there's a lot of divergence.
Matthew, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You say the Amish are trilingual, so they speak?
They speak English, and they read and write in English. Most of their reading and writing is in English. The breakfast language as they grow up is Pennsylvania Dutch, and that includes all the Amish in North America, except for a small group in Indiana where it's more of a Swiss German. And then their hymns and their prayers and other religious writings, traditional ones, are in older German. It's like the German of Martin Luther at the time. They use Luther's Bible. So it's an old 16th, 17th century German, sort of pre-modern German. So in that sense, they're trilingual.
And did the words Pennsylvania Dutch really come from Pennsylvania Deutsch? I mean, that has its German?
Not really. Deutsch, and they would say Deutsch, was a general word for Northern Europeans at one point. And so this has nothing to do with Holland. And it's more a historical label in Europe that would have been used for a lot of people that were like in Northern Europe. It is a dialect that comes from Germany. I mean, the actual spoken Pennsylvania Deutsch, really from the Palatinate area near the Rhine in southern Germany and the Alsace area of current-day France. And so it's a dialect that now has evolved. There are a lot of technological words like refrigerator, computer, or tractor that the Amish just add in English because it doesn't have an older component, obviously, in the dialect.
Let me see what Ryan from Pottstown has to say. Ryan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty, for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to ask the author, what is the Mennonite or Amish notion of property? And the reason I ask is I go out there often to look for scrap wood or to hunt geese, to look for arrowheads, and they're always so open and welcoming. They never turn me away. They just treat it as if the property were not theirs to control. And it's just fascinating.
Well, that's interesting, Ryan.
I think he's just a nice. You're a nice guy, and they just like you, and you have a good way with them. They actually own private property. They're not communalist, economic communalist. They have private enterprise. They own private property, and I was sort of serious about your comment. I mean, if they're open to outside people, to English people, and if people treat them decently, they return. Return that kind of treatment.
Ryan, thanks for the call. And English, is that the word for outsiders?
It comes from the fact that in the Amish mindset, the world, the linguistic world is cut in half. It's like those people that speak Pennsylvania Dutch and those that speak English. So it has nothing to do with people coming from Britain or the UK. It's all about what your native tongue is, what the mother tongue is, and so they would refer to other Mennonites. There are some traditional Mennonites that speak Pennsylvania Deutsch, so there's a similarity and solidarity with the like-minded speakers. So it means those outsiders that speak a different language.
Let me see what Ilana from Radnor has to say. Ilana, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I would like for the speaker to comment on the association between the puppy mills in Pennsylvania and the fact that they're mostly run by Amish. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Is that true?
I don't believe there's evidence that the bulk of the puppy mills are run by Amish. There are, I think there's a higher number that are old order Mennonite, and they're easily confused with Amish. The fact of the matter is that the attitude toward animals, and particularly toward dogs in the Amish and older Mennonite community, would be very similar to rural farming attitudes in early 20th century. And so it's very different than a suburban or inner city view of a dog where, everybody, you have a dog and it's like
part of the family,
your pet,
right?
And part of the family. The view of animals in rural America is more like these are working animals and so on. And so the emergence of these farms that grew puppies for pet stores and so on were looking for additional income, particularly for their children, where the children could work and stay at home and be part of it. So it was that rural American attitude and looking for work for children that I think led to the emergence of it. Now, I think there's been much better enforcement in the last 5 years, and I think the abuses that we would have seen 15 years ago have largely disappeared because of the Pennsylvania enforcement agencies that really have set new standards and much better enforcement.
Elena, thanks for the call to Radio Times. A bit of a weird segue, but we only have about a minute before we have to say goodbye to you. But you also write about snowbirds, Amish snowbirds, that end up in Pinecraft, Florida. I guess when the weather's cold in Pennsylvania, they might go to Florida.
These are
to warm
snowbirds.
Up.
Typically, they are Amish from either Pennsylvania or Ohio. They tend to be older, and they tend to be more from the business class of Amish people that have the freedom to travel. And so they'll go to Pinecraft. This is like a little village that suddenly comes alive with maybe 500 or 600 people, little cottages owned by Amish people who rent them out to each other. And so it's a wintertime vacation, basically, for 6 or 8 weeks. They don't have horses there, and so they're riding around in big three-wheel tricycles in scooters and fishing. And some young people go down, too, to enjoy the beach on Rumspringa. So it's a mix of things.
Well, I learned a lot reading your book and talking with you, Donald Craybill. Thank you very much for joining us today.
My delight to be here.
Nice to have you here. And again, the book is called The Amish, and Donald Craybill, one of three authors of that book. And he's also a distinguished professor at Elizabethtown College. He's written a number of books about the Amish as well. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Our intern today is Nick Sessler. Kevin Griffin, our engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, with help from Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.